Black women get so mad when they see us walking down the street with a white girl. I turned slowly toward this handsome, ebony boy and said, "Do you really want to know the answer to that question?" He said, "Yeah, I really want to know. I get sick of that shit." I said, "Well, it might have something to do with this. For decades, black men were lynched, often for allegedly looking at a white woman. Our mothers' mothers cut the black bodies of their sons and husbands down from the trees. But we black women did something we didn't have to do before we buried them. First, we washed their bodies." I let my words sink in and continued. "So, little boy, when you see a black woman walking down the street, you tilt your hat and acknowledge her existence. If only for the fact that first we washed you. And the next time you sit down next to me, you say, 'Excuse me, Miss Lewis. Now get the fuck on where you're going. I'm studying Brecht, little boy.'" About 2 years later, I was again living in the city temporarily. This time, during my run as Motormouth Mabel, the black mother character in Hairspray. I was provided a nice one-bedroom apartment with a great view on the 28th floor of a high-rise that had a pool on the lower level. It was all very movie star on Broadway, if you know what I mean. Every day of that sweltering hot summer seemed to serve up at least one quintessential New York experience. I'll never forget the day I rode the Circle Line tour boat past an astounding public art exhibit where they had erected a waterfall underneath the Brooklyn Bridge. Another memory of that New York summer is the reaction of the passengers when I rode the N train between shows in my Motormouth makeup, which of course was shocking up close in that garish light. And I will definitely never forget the time I decided to do my own laundry and inadvertently found a new meaning in the phrase, "separate the whites." Although any sane person who is singing and dancing in 8 shows a week would have someone else handle her wash, I'm a clean freak and find it highly disturbing to stare at a load of dirty clothes. So I decided to truck on down to the 3rd floor laundry room and do it myself. I separated the whites into a basket and used pillowcases for darks and the light colors. I stood in my sweats and house shoes at the bank of 4 elevators, waiting in the middle. When the elevator door opened to the far left, I scooped up the basket, ran over, and plopped it in the door's path to keep it open. I asked the older couple in the elevator to wait a second while I grabbed the other 2 bags. I ran to get them, but as I turned back, I heard the woman say loudly, "We're not waiting for you!" With that, she kicked my laundry basket out of the elevator, its contents spilling out onto the floor. I began to rumble like the Northridge earthquake of 1994. Truth be told, I was overdue for a phone session with my therapist, Rachel, and was carrying a lot of pent-up anxiety. When I saw the basket fly out of the elevator, I launched my body between the doors in one rage-fueled leap to stop them from closing. Then, while keeping my eyes on the couple's eyes, I knelt down and ever so slowly placed my whites one by one back into the basket. White sock by white sock, white towel by white towel, white crotchless panty by white crotchless panty. When finished, I straightened up, stepped into the elevator, and let the door close. I pushed 3. Turned to face the white couple, and in a normal, even tone of voice said, "Well, that was rude." The woman snapped back. "Look, we're in a hurry!" Before she got the entire statement out of her mouth, I was a half inch from her nose. Drawing on vocal cords that had been reaching the back row of the theater, I roared, "Shut the fuck up! You lost the right to speak when you kick my shit!" The old man stepped toward me as to reach out and protect the woman. See, if there was a first blow to be delivered, it wasn't coming from me. I never strike first. I had sense enough to remember there are cameras on elevators. The man stepped toward me. I turned my head with eyes blazing, and through clenched teeth I said, "Don't you move." He went rigid. I continued in a low, level tone. "You lost the right to do anything when you let her kick my shit." Ooh, baby, that was just the introduction to my diatribe. "What are you people made of?" I shouted, my voice amplified in the small cabin. "After 9/11, the Holocaust, the Middle Passage." And when I realized they didn't know what the Middle Passage even was, that made me even madder. So I really went in, "Have you no souls? Have you not heard of the brotherhood of mankind?" I berated them for the duration of the 25-floor descent, probably for close to a minute. I'm sure it felt like hours for the couple who stood stiffly, their eyes wide. At one point, the elevator stopped and the doors opened. A young, executive-type Asian woman stepped forward, but sensing the tension, quickly retreated, whispering,
"I'll wait for the next one."
As we reached the third floor, I yelled, "And another thing!" The doors opened right on time as I gathered my laundry and cheerfully exited the elevator with, "Now y'all have a nice day." Later I learned that that couple reported me to the concierge, describing me as a crazy maid. But the joke was on them. The staff knew and loved me and figured out for themselves what had taken place. They told me that particular couple treated everyone disrespectfully as a matter of course. Before leaving for the evening's performance, I found an anonymous note taped to my door that read, "The couple who were racist toward you this morning are in suite number 2908. Handle your business, Miss Lewis." It felt good to have the support of the building staff. But I decided to let it go. You've got to choose your battles. And I had a show to do. That night on stage in Hairspray, I sang my ass off, performing I Know Where I've Been, the showstopper about the civil rights movement, thinking about racism, segregation, and my own experience that day having to separate the whites. 3. Don't Tell Mama. About a week after I first arrived in the Big Apple, Miguel left for the Dominican Republic to care for his sick grandmother. That was fine with me because I was feeling a bit cramped by his requests for marriage. Miguel's departure spurred me to say goodbye to his mom's apartment and move into a small one-bedroom with Mark Alton Brown and Robert Bobby Cesario. Mark and Bobby were friends from Webster University, whom I met during my first week there. I'd walked into a busy dining room hall, sporting afro puffs and a checkered pantsuit, and spied 2 men sitting together. I sashayed over to where they were seated, and without so much as introducing myself, I leaned over and put my elbows on their table so my face was level with theirs. Which man in this cafeteria do you think I fucked last night? I asked, glancing around the crowded hall, allowing my gaze to land on Miguel. Both Mark and Bobby fell in love with me in that moment. At the same time, they fell in love with each other. For the next 2 years at Webster, and then throughout our lives, the three of us have been thick as thieves. Mark and Bobby were already juniors when we met at college, and then they moved to New York City about 2 years before I arrived. Like me, Mark and Bobby had showbiz aspirations. When I moved in, Mark was scooping ice cream at Haagen-Dazs, and Bobby was pounding the pavement for acting jobs. I'd been living at Mark and Bobby's place on Broadway and 101st Street for just a couple of days when I decided to hike the 30 blocks or so downtown to my favorite place for a cheap, delicious meal. The Upper West Side of the late 1970s was a gritty neighborhood, rich with an abundance of dive bars, diners, and coffee shops. At Gray's Papaya on the corner of 72nd Street and Broadway, I could get a couple of hot dogs slathered in mustard and a little relish along with a sweet fruity beverage for around $2. It was late evening. I stood on the filthy street corner jamming the second hot dog into my mouth and suddenly recognized a face in the stream walking by. It was Danny Hogate, the music supervisor for Yubi, the hit show of the 1978-79 Broadway season. The previous November, I had flown to New York during my senior year to audition for the Yubi National Tour. At the audition, Danny had accompanied me as I sang Everything's Coming Up Roses from Gypsy. I was so green, it didn't occur to me to sing a black song or even a song by the show's namesake, Yubi Blake. Everything's Coming Up Roses for me and for you. I belted the iconic song, finishing the audition in a full backbend and holding the final note so long that Danny was forced to look around the upright piano to see when I'd finally release it. I didn't get the gig. I pushed myself into Danny's path in front of Gray's Papaya as I wiped my mouth with a damp yellow stained napkin. Danny! Danny! Remember me? Hi, I'm Jennifer Lewis. You don't remember me, but I auditioned. He interrupted me. Oh, yeah. You're the one that did that backbend. Obviously, I'd made an impression. I think they need somebody in the show right now. Danny continued. Come on, walk with me. I'm going to pick up some Chinese food. I was nervous because I had mustard smeared on my blouse, and he was a big, important person in the theater world. Well, timing is everything. Turned out, Yubi was looking for a replacement for a wonderful actress named Gina Taylor. Long story short, on June 5th, 1979, exactly 11 days after graduating from college, I made my Broadway debut in Yubi at the Ambassador Theater. Broadway. I had never doubted I would perform on The Great White Way. No joke here, folks. That one's too easy, okay? Mark Brown told me he cried when he saw my name on the marquee at the Ambassador, because he knew I had dreamed of this my whole life. It only took you 11 days, Jennifer. I felt pride, amazement. But I was also keenly aware of the 8,030 days that had brought me there. Yes, I did the math. Yubi was a review honoring the work of James Hubert Blake, the first African-American to write, direct, and star in a musical on Broadway. The acclaimed musical review starred Gregory Hines and Maurice Hines. I barely remember my first Yubi performance. I stood in the wings awaiting my cue. A little nervous, but definitely not scared. My only concern was that I not disappoint my fellow cast members. I wanted them to see me as their peer. Suddenly, I was on stage, singing and dancing in a hit show with some of the most talented entertainers on Broadway. After I sang my featured song, "If You've Never Been Vamped by a Brown Skin, You've Never Been Vamped at All," I barely heard the applause. It was the faces of my castmates that told me I had done well. I had stepped into a new world, the world of my dreams. I was the baby in the cast, but I felt safe with the veterans. I knew they were rooting for me. Even though I was not creating the role, I found ways to make it my own. Like if the choreography called for 2 steps, I might take 2.5. Nothing to disturb my fellow actors, just a little something to put my stamp on it. I was attracted to Gregory Hines. Well, who wasn't? And we flirted a bit, but mostly just became friends. He was a big prankster. Once, as we performed a sophisticated Blake Sissel song called "A Million Little Cupids in the Sky," in which the choreography called for Gregory to hold me with my back to his front, I felt an enormous lump pressing against my ass as we swayed and dipped. I barely held my giggles as I realized Gregory was sporting a pair of rolled-up socks in his pants. Performing in my first Broadway show was fun, but it was intense, requiring me to focus my entire being on my performance. Most days, I would wake up around 3 in the afternoon, eat, stretch, and in order to open my lungs, power walk to the theater. After warm-up and vocalizing, I was on stage and life began. Everything fell into place for me once the conductor raised his baton. It was exhilarating. The music, the dancing, the response of the audience. Nothing else existed when I was standing in front of that many people. I could feel the energy from their eyes, hear the thump of their heartbeats. In these moments, I could read their souls and sense their innermost emotions. When you're good, you will deliver precisely the right performance for the audience at hand. In turn, the audience will deliver your reward, applause and adulation. Whew! It felt exciting to become a part of the Black Broadway community. There was always the show after the show, and I soon found myself hanging out with towering figures of the theater. The likes of Hinton Battle, Ethel Beatty, Nell Carter, who at first was not having my young Afro-wearing ass. Amelia McQueen, Vivian Reed, Ken Page, Marion Ramsey, Andre DeShields, and on and on. Initially, I would eggshell around these grand idols. But usually, within 10 minutes, I'd have them all laughing. We gypsies, meaning anyone who has been on Broadway, especially in the chorus, had our own world, our own language. "Cha, you peed all over that stage," meant your performance was incredible. And if you were truly extraordinary, well then, girl, you turned that shit out. We spoke only of show business, quoting old movies, singing in piano bars, and telling jokes. I felt embraced, a rightful part of the crowd, even though 1 or 2 dismissed me as just the newest sweet young thing. Believe me, I have never been sweet, and there was not a damn thing young about my talent. Case in point, I understudied Elena Reed. Remember Olivia from Sesame Street? On 2 spirited Blake songs, "Roll, Jordan, Roll," and "My Handyman Ain't Handy No More." When Elena was out for a few performances, I took the stage in her role. Later, she returned to backstage gossip that I had gotten standing ovations singing her songs. She didn't speak to me for a week. Now, up to this point, Elena had been cool. She had even invited me to her place in Harlem for collards and cornbread. So my feelings were hurt. Okay, not that hurt. But y'all, this wasn't all about Eve. I wasn't trying to take her part. Okay, maybe I was, so sue me. Making that steady Broadway money in Ubi allowed me to leave Mark and Bobby's place and move into my first apartment. In mid-September, I rented a cute studio in the La Premiere, a new building on the corner of 55th and Broadway. It was a great location, right in the heart of the theater district, with the Applejack Diner conveniently located a few steps around the corner. We're talking 10-minute delivery, y'all. Rent was $450 a month. I love telling people that I lived in a luxury high-rise, but failed to mention I was on the lowest floor in the smallest apartment. It was fun to take my friends to the rooftop, where there was an incredible panoramic view. You could look down on the Winter Garden Theater, Times Square, and the Hudson River. And to the north was a partial view of my beloved Central Park. Nobody could tell me I wasn't right where I was supposed to be. But let's not forget that New York City can be a nasty, two-faced monster, too. It will serve you diamonds with dirt, caviar with shit, pleasure with pain. I learned this firsthand after I'd been living in the city a few years, and the New York Times crowned me the reigning queen of High Camp Cabaret for my one-woman show, How I Spent My Summer Vacation, which was selling out every night at Don't Tell Mama, the hottest cabaret in Manhattan. As a result of the show's success, I was selected by the New York Daily News to be a Wingo girl. There I was in a full-page picture, cheesing it up in my vacation costume in a white bikini, fishnets, and white sunglasses. Nearly 1 million New Yorkers bought the Daily News that day. I awoke around noon to the phone ringing and John, the doorman, buzzing up to say Western Union was coming up with a telegram and that there were two bouquets waiting for me at the front desk. I opened the door smiling as I took the telegram. I had worked hard to make vacation a success and felt on top of the world. I lit a scented candle that I kept on the bedstand next to my open Bible and went into my small bathroom to run a steaming aromatherapy bath. As I bent over to tap 2 drops of essential peppermint oil into the water, my little Maltese, Jenta, jumped up and bumped my elbow, causing me to dump in half the bottle. I was quickly overwhelmed by the peppermint fumes and the thick steam. And when I opened the bathroom door, the pungent fog filled my entire little studio apartment. Just then, John buzzed again to say a delivery guy had a package for me. Okay, send him up. I opened the door to a young man holding an envelope with Don't Tell Mama in a childish handwriting across the front. He looked quickly to his left and right, and within seconds was inside my apartment, holding a kitchen knife to my throat. As I stood in paralysis, the cloud of peppermint fumes took quick effect on the man, causing him to wince and blink, clearly taken aback as his senses were invaded. What do you want? You know what I want. Jenta started jumping up happily on him. Put the dog in the bathroom. Do you mind if I cut the water off? Yeah, cut it off. I did so, and then closed the door, leaving Jenta in the bathroom, worrying she would become sick from the smell. By now, the peppermint fumes were overpowering in the room. He put the wooden-handled knife back at my throat and led me to the window. Are you expecting anybody? My boyfriend is on his way over. Close the blinds. As I reached for the blinds, like so many assault victims, I thought, is this really happening to me? Dear God, what have I done to deserve this? I couldn't think of a thing I had done to warrant this moment. Then all the stuff I had been reading about past life regression kicked in, and suddenly the image was clear as day for me. In a previous life, I had cut off this boy's head in one swoosh with a medieval sword. Now his soul had returned to take revenge. Shock descended, and everything went into slow motion as I closed the blinds. Take your clothes off. I did so, feeling as though I were moving through cement. Get on the bed. On your back. I followed his directions, and then watched as he pushed his dark polyester pants down his legs to his shoes. He lay on top of me, putting his head on my shoulder and holding the knife in his left hand. In an almost gentle way, he slowly rocked back and forth. Not rough, not urgent. He struggled quietly to get his huge penis hard. We both seemed to be miscast actors in a horrible movie scene. He seemed unsure, as if he was new to this. The thick peppermint aroma surrounding us was almost calming. When I turned my head to the right, I saw our reflection in the mirror next to the bed. The young man almost seemed to have forgotten me as he tugged at his limp flesh. In the mirror, I saw his left hand relax briefly, silently dropping the knife on the bedspread. My right hand was free, and I put my hand around the knife handle without him realizing it. As I raised my arm to plunge the knife into the man's back, the stainless steel blade flashed the glare of the candle flame at my eye. I stopped my hand in midair. It was like the reflected candle sparked deep knowledge in my soul. Suddenly, I was clear that violence was not the answer. I wanted to see neither my blood nor his on my bedspread. I dropped the knife on the bed and undertook the greatest performance of my life. In a low, even tone, I asked, "What's your name?" "James." "Can I tell you something, James?"
"What?"
"You smell that medicine?" He raised up on his hands, blinking his eyes against the invasive scent.
"Yeah, what is that?"
"I'm sick, and that's the medicine I have to soak in every day."
"What's wrong with you?"
I paraphrased something my mother had said to me about a friend's illness. "It's a disease, and they don't know what it is. I was raped."
"You were raped? Where?"
"Down over on 10th Avenue."
"What were you doing on 10th Avenue?"
"Walking my dog." This was believable to him. He looked me in the eyes for the first time. "Look, if you go inside of me, you're going to get sick. Let me get you off. I have Vaseline in the bathroom."
Okay.
He rolled off me. I got up and started toward the bathroom.
"Stop!"
I thought, damn. He snapped, and this is it. But when I turned around, the young man was sitting on the bed with his head in his hands, crying. He looked at me,
Put your clothes back on. I quickly complied as he continued to speak. I shouldn't be doing this shit, especially to a sister. They locked me up for some shit I didn't do. I just got out.
Suddenly I saw how skinny, fragile, and vulnerable this kid was. I realized I could probably kick his ass. Instead, I sat down next to him and put my arm around his shoulder. I'm sorry that happened to you, James. You see this Bible? I have this here to help me through hard times. I will help you, James. Let me give you my number and you can call me. I walked to the kitchenette and got a paper and pencil. From the nightclub, I had $400 in tens and twenties sitting on the counter. He could have easily taken it. But he wasn't looking for money. He was looking to hurt because he had been hurt. I well understood emotional pain. I gave him the paper with a telephone number on it. You should go, James. My boyfriend is coming. Go on now. I won't tell. I won't. James looked at my piano and spoke like a little boy. You play piano? Yeah, but you gotta go now. I'm sorry. I know you're gonna tell. But I just want you to know I'm sorry. He was not evil. He was just fucked up. He left. I stood still for a moment, then quickly opened the bathroom door as Jenta jumped into my arms. I fell to my knees and fainted. When I came to, I thanked God for my life. Sweet Bobby came over immediately, and that afternoon, he and Mark took me to the station house to report the assault. The detective said, "Miss Lewis, you will suffer some emotional stress over this, but keep this in the front of your mind. Only 1 in 3 million women can talk her way out of rape, especially once the door closes." When I called Thomas, my boyfriend at the time, he couldn't handle it. "Don't walk me through it. I couldn't tell Mama or my siblings. I was too far from home, and I knew they'd be worried sick." The next day, I fled to Boston. I was sure Timmy and June, two friends about 20 years my senior, would give me the love and security I needed. I knew and trusted those divas. They had had so much therapy over the years, they knew exactly how to help me heal. I was tormented by the what ifs. June said, "Jennifer, you have the right to your thoughts. Have them all. Feel them all. So you can get up and keep going." They dragged me to a lake in Brookline, and I found solace in the beauty of New England in the fall. There's nothing like a bond between women during a crisis. They comforted me and reminded me of my own power. After a couple of days, I felt better, although I continued to look over my shoulder for months. But the show must go on. And my beloved New York, despite it all, was still my city. I had been performing in Ubi for several months when one late September day, I arrived at the Ambassador at half hour and saw Gregory Hines and all the other cast members standing around the call board looking gloomy. They told me the show was closing October 7th, just 2 weeks away. I was so young and new to showbiz that I didn't realize that Broadway shows even closed. "Excuse me? We're closing? Well, now what do we do?" I remember how Maurice Hines just looked at me. Clearly, he couldn't believe my naivete. Here were the great Hines brothers, and I was standing there with my big afro wondering, what do we do now? Where's the next show? The female lead in Ubi was Terry Burrell,
She and her sister Deborah Burrell, both extremely talented performers, were about my age, and I became close friends with them. I heard Terry say, "Me and my sister Debbie, we're doing a club act." Well, I knew what that was, and I asked, "Can I do it too?" Terry said, "Why don't you open for us?" I didn't really know what that meant, but as long as there was a stage, I was ready. Thus, I entered the world of cabaret in New York City. Terry and Debbie had a gig at the Bushes, a tiny nightclub, where I sat at a little white piano and sang Sam Cooke's You Send Me and two other songs. The Burrell sisters were fabulous, but on the first night, I realized I want to be the star, not the opening act. I was the opening act only twice more, for the singing group Gallagher and stand-up comic Jackie Mason. After that, I made a rule. Nobody goes on after Jennifer Lewis, said with humility, of course. I did the Bushes for a few weeks, but with no other major gig in the wings, I began to fret as my finances dwindled. A gypsy friend suggested I check with the Actors Fund, a charitable organization that would give a few bucks to an out-of-work actor like me. The folks at the fund were real nice and hardly asked me any questions. I walked out of the office with $40 that would at least cover my food for the next week or so. But I was wishing it was $4,000. Walking back home through Times Square, my attention was caught by a handful of people crowded around a small, makeshift cardboard table. The eyes of the crowd followed the quick hands of a short brother in a backwards cap as he shuffled three cards around the table in a lightning-fast round of three-card Monty. He was talking fast, encouraging the onlookers. "Find the Black Queen and win 10-1. This is my chance. I was sure I could turn my $40 into $400 in just a few moments. Pushing my way through to the table, I watched two rounds, feeling smug because both times I correctly guessed which of the three cards was the Black Queen. The next round started. The brother switched the cards back and forth on the table really fast and shouted, "Place your bets, my people. We paying 10-1. With the most confidence I had ever felt in my entire motherfucking life, I put my 220s on the middle card. Within 5 seconds, I was as broke as I had been a half hour earlier. Y'all, I never gambled again. I took my last couple of dollars to get some fruit at a bodega on the corner of 55th and Broadway. When who do I bump into but Gregory Hines? "Hey, Jennifer, did you audition for my new show? It's called Coming Uptown." He gave me the address. "Tell the choreographer I sent you." I ran the short block to my apartment and put on a wig I had stolen from the Oriental Blues number in Ubi. 10 years later, I would be on the cover of the Los Angeles Times art section, wearing that same wig, and it was crooked. It took me just 10 minutes to put on some mascara and some red lips and power walk to the rehearsal space off Broadway. As the lyric from a chorus line goes, I went up a steep and very narrow stairway in my flowing polyester red top and black tights to audition for Coming Uptown. It was an outfit my blackish character Ruby Johnson would have loved, but I was 40 pounds lighter then. Once again, I belted out my stock audition number, "Everything's Coming Up Roses." The choreographer then asked me, "Can you dance?" As I've said, I've never been a great dancer. But like Streisand in the audition scene in Funny Girl, where she's asked, "Can you skate?" I said, "Absolutely."
If it might get me the job, then hell yeah, I'll go for it. In that moment, everything fell into place. The cheerleading at Kinloch High, the study of dynamics and Feldenkrais in college, and the vaudeville moves I had learned while touring with Baggy Pants. I drew back and pow, my highest kick into a fantastic bop ma into a grand layout. I don't think I impressed the director, Philip Rose, but Michael Peters, the choreographer, went nuts. Yes, that Michael Peters, the choreographer who would go on to win a Tony for Dreamgirls, but who is perhaps most famous for his genius work on the music videos for Michael Jackson's Thriller and Beat It. I got the job. My second Broadway show in just 6 months of arriving in New York City. Coming Uptown was a musical update of Charles Dickens' A Christmas Carol. Gregory Hines played Scrooge, reimagined as a Harlem slumlord. I played one of the Salvation Army trio, which included Debbie Burrell and Deborah Bridges. Loretta Devine was making her second Broadway appearance, too. This was also the show where I became close friends with Shirley Black Brown, a former Ailey dancer who played Bob Cratchit's daughter. The show opened at the Winter Garden Theater in December 1979, but ran for fewer than 50 performances. 4. Dick Diva. Like most successful Broadway shows, UB Spawn, a national touring company, I got cast in the upcoming 6-month tour just 2 days after Coming Uptown closed. The day before I departed for the tour, Ken, a journalist friend, came over for a little afternoon delight. Right after he left, Perry called and said he was leaving town and wanted to see me. Dear, delicious Perry. We have been lovers since my sophomore year at Webster. During my breakups from Miguel, of course, Perry had moved to New York City to pursue a show business career. I recall the first time I saw Perry, as I stepped out of my dorm room on an all-girls floor where I lived. I knew immediately that he had to be a dancer because of his long, shapely physique. Perry had trained with the great Katherine Dunham at her studio in East St. Louis. When I saw him, a freshman wandering around looking lost, I had only one thought. Come into my parlor, said the spider to the fly. Fans of Tennessee Williams, a streetcar named Desire, might have called my dorm room the Tarantula Arms. That afternoon, Perry and I began a pattern of loving up on each other between relationships that would continue for several decades. We made love the entire night before I arose at dawn to fly to Los Angeles for the start of the UB National Tour. I landed in L.A. with a terrible cold. Linda Saputo, a Webster friend, whose outstanding talents had taken her to Hollywood, picked me up at the airport and drove me straight to the theater. My cold was really bad. So on the recommendation of Kelly, the company manager, that afternoon I went to an acupuncturist named Mrs. Chin. It seemed she porcupined my ass, but damn if those 10,000 needles didn't eliminate most of my cold symptoms. After she removed the last needle, she looked into my eyes, squinted, and spoke harshly in her thick Chinese accent.
How many boyfriend you got?
Excuse me?
How many boyfriend you got last night?
One. Mrs. Chin's squint grows tighter.
Okay, two. You listen to me very carefully. Two men with one woman make one woman poison.
How the hell did Mrs. Chin know I had sex with two men on the same day? I ran out of there as fast as I could.
Years later, after reading Louise L. Hay's You Can Heal Your Life, I learned that some people have the skill to just look at you and know where you are sick. It's in your body language, your face, and most certainly the eyes. I was thrilled to be a part of the UB National Tour and grateful to be working with a wonderful cast of talented, fabulous gypsies. Touring companies are like unconventional families. We were young and energetic, dancing and singing through 8 shows a week. Our stamina equaled that of any Olympian. The show was getting rave reviews, and I felt blown away by the effusive praise my performance received from the newspaper critics. Half laser beam, half lava flow. Vibrant stage presence. Meteoric voice. Could hold the note from here to September. When the show moved to the Studebaker Theater in Chicago, my father's family bought out a couple of roles. My parents had separated when I was 2 weeks old. Daddy lived in St. Louis, but there was a huge contingent of Lewises in Chicago. These were South Side family people. You know, Patty, Pinky, Popo, Minky, Keisha, Junior, and them. I felt proud. These were aunts and cousins who had heard me proclaiming my stardom since childhood. For them to see me on stage at the Studebaker was exhilarating. They were so supportive and happy for me. "Go on, Jenny," they shouted from the audience, clapping and whooping as I belted Roll Jordan Roll and shook my moneymaker. The party continued well into the night when at least a dozen Chicago relatives came back to my hotel room after the show. They brought buckets of fried chicken and Tupperware filled with spaghetti, potato salad, collards, and chitlins. There were coolers of cold beer, soda, pop, as they call it in Chi-Town, and Kool-Aid, plus 9 or 10 fifths of hard liquor and a bottle of Ripple to boot. I invited the entire UB company. When you're on the road, home-cooked food was always a treat. Gypsies are nocturnal creatures. We would do the show and then go to bars or club where we sing, drink, and likely pick up a piece. The term gypsies used for the civilians they'd meet in a club and spend the night with. For me, nothing could extend the thrill of a standing ovation like great sex with a gorgeous guy. After all, I deserved my reward for a job well done. Not only was it fun, but I discovered that sex could lessen the crash I sometimes experienced when I came off stage. It's pretty common to have a heightened sense of self when you're performing. A rush of bliss. And an almost uncontrollable sense of accomplishment. Like what runners feel when the endorphins kick in. The applause coming over the footlights is like a slow-motion tsunami of adoration. Like jumping on a spaceship and riding it bareback to Pluto. The crash after the show, I assure you, is just as intense. Let's just say I had a sort of unconscious habit of using post-show sex to come back to Earth. Well, unconscious habit isn't really accurate. I wore my sexuality like a medal. I was Cleopatra, Pam Grier, Marilyn Monroe, and Jezebel rolled into one. A jaguar with skin supple as a baby's ass, capturing my prey with lust and laughter. Then, ever the alpha, it was I who chose the locations, the positions, and the durations. Okay, let me be frank. I did a lot of fucking during those years of crisscrossing the nation in concerts and shows. But hey, everybody was having a lot of sex. The sexual revolution was still in full swing. Despite my Baptist upbringing, I'd been sexually active since my teens, and as a young woman, I was pleased with my ability to attract men and had never been shy about talking about my sexual escapades. In fact, I cracked everybody up with my exaggerated stories. Girl, it was so big that when he stood up in the bathtub, he knocked out my front tooth. Ultimately, my girlfriends nicknamed me Dick Diva. My men were handsome, talented, and accomplished. I mean, no scrubs. For instance, there was the club bouncer in Chicago who looked like a black Clark Gable. One night after earning two ovations, I knew I wasn't going to bed alone. I escaped drinks with the rest of the UB cast and went off on my own to a disco. As the bouncer unhooked the velvet rope for me, he flashed a perfect set of teeth with a big, ultra-bright smile. He was so beautiful, there was no thought in my brain other than, nigga, you going down. We spent a few hours at the club chatting about his travels and studies before I took him back to my hotel and drew a bubble bath. That was my ritual with new conquests. My way of assessing the goods. It was a tactic that I learned in Kinlock as a young teen. Me and my girlfriend Ethel Rue decided to skip junior high school one day. We were walking down Cranberry Road when a big white Cadillac pulled up. It was Fat Jackie, the town prostitute. She hollered out of the car, "Y'all skipping school? Get y'all's asses in this car. Go on, get in the back seat." Me and Ethel were scared we would get in big trouble for playing hooky. Fat Jackie was just driving along, and when she got to a stop sign, she put her right elbow over the seat and looked back at us. She had rings on damn near every finger, blonde coif grazing the car roof, two gold front teeth, and a fried chicken leg in her right hand. She pointed that chicken leg at us and said, "Y'all fucking yet?" Personally, I had only made out once with Jesse under the bleachers at school, but I knew Ethel was already on a fast track to getting pregnant with Raymond's baby. Naturally, we both said, "No, ma'am." Fat Jackie said, "Yeah, well, when you do start fucking, make sure you always check the meat." Well, we didn't know if she was talking about bologna, ham, or spam, especially since she was waving that chicken leg. She went on to explain, "I carry a flashlight wherever I go. Some men always want to keep the lights off, but I always check the meat. You girls hear me?" She jabbed that drumstick in the air to punctuate her words. "Always check the meat." By this time, Ethel and I were pressed against each other in the back seat, scared to death. Fat Jackie pulled up in front of the school and said, "Now get the hell out of this car and go get y'all's education. Next time, I'm gonna tell y'all's mamas." Running from the car as fast as we could, we heard Fat Jackie yell once more, "Be sure you check the meat every time!" In the bubble bath, I checked out the bouncer, Mr. Clark Gable, whose name was actually Maurice. He turned out to be a master of Shotokan karate, with an 8-pack torso and a dick the size of a small garden gnome. I sank lower in the bubbles, thinking, "Merry Christmas." For the next couple of weeks while UB played Chicago, Maurice joined my rotation of sex partners, which also included a musician I'd met named Steve, along with Ken and Perry via phone. Usually I would see a guy for a few months, often juggling him with a few others. Yes, y'all, I was skilled. Things were going pretty well until I found out Steve was planning to get married. Like I said, I've always been dramatic. Steve's news gave me overwhelming pain, and I missed a performance because of it. Not that I wanted to marry him. I had a rule, never to mess with other women's men. But not to worry, Steve was soon replaced with Pierre and Jerome. The tour moved on to the Music Hall Center for the Performing Arts in Detroit. They put us up at a dump called the Leyland Hotel, which fortunately had a piano in the bar. Never show a gypsy a bar with a piano.
The show is on. We gathered in that bar every night. Basically, I had a man in every port. Although I started off in Detroit dickless, I soon met Leon, a professional masseuse who gave me a massage in my hotel room and came back 2 days later for sex. Needing attention from more than one man, I felt the need to check in with all my boyfriends. I called Ken, the journalist in New York, and Maurice in Chicago. I hung up when a woman answered Maurice's phone. I've kept a journal since junior high school and wrote journal entry. Que sera, sera, motherfucker. Despite this merry-go-round of men, Miguel, who was still in the Dominican Republic, always remained in the lead position. One of the most popular recording artists around this time was the sultry Phyllis Hyman. When I heard she was playing in Detroit, of course I had to go see her. Phyllis was a sexy, quiet Amazon who demanded your attention. You would bow down as soon as she hit the stage. Her stunning beauty, 6-foot frame, and that big-ass hat she always wore made her an imposing and impressive live performer. I admired Phyllis, not only for her talent. In television interviews, she had spoken out about racism in the music industry and the price she had paid for being a black woman and telling it like it is. Phyllis was not a belter like me. She was softer and quieter, but still very powerful. Most important, she had achieved the success that I dreamed of. Watching her sing was a rush because it was proof that my dream was possible. Through my eyes, that was me on that stage. Her performance and mastery thrilled and excited me to the point I couldn't get to sleep until 8 the next morning, which caused me to sleep right through our matinee show. But I was still willing to take the hit of losing a day's pay to experience the great Phyllis Hyman. During the weeks on the road, it seemed like I always had a cold. No surprise, considering my diet consisted of chips, pickles, and Manischewitz wine. I ate lots of cheese, which I now know puts mucus on the vocal cords. I also had no clue that a steady diet of Kentucky Fried Chicken and donuts wasn't a good idea. It wasn't surprising, then, that midway through the Detroit run, I had to have my costume let out a full inch. Maxie, the head of wardrobe, looked me dead in the eye and gave me some of the best advice of my life. She had spent years in the theater and witnessed numerous svelte entertainers bloom beyond the point of no return. "Don't do it, Jennifer," she said sternly. "You'll never be able to get it off." Her advice has stayed with me and is one of the reasons that 30 years later, I am still in pretty good shape and still cute. Thank you very much. After Detroit, there was a short break in the tour, so I flew back to Manhattan for a couple of weeks. Landing at Kennedy, I took a bus to Columbus Circle. It was in the midst of the Great Transit Strike of 1980. So I had to roll my suitcase the few blocks down 8th Avenue to my apartment. It felt good to be home, to feel invigorated by New York City's unique pulse. I walked down to Colony Records and bought the new Dionne Warwick album that included I'll Never Love This Way Again. I couldn't wait to wrap my vocal cords around those high notes come next audition. Despite my resolve to watch my weight, I treated myself to a Sunday at Howard Johnson's. I started to crash from having been on tour so long. I found it very difficult to adjust after the excitement and elevation of performing every night. My solution was to blast Ethel Merman until the wee hours. My poor neighbors. Come the next morning, I was back to my routine of dance class and voice lessons every day.
I was hanging tough with Terry Burrell and Shirley Black Brown, who would always bring the weed. I never bought it. Then we'd go shopping. You do not want me shopping when I'm high.